This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in December of 2019 dealing with issues relevant to negligence. The summaries of these decisions were initially published on the New York Appellate Digest website in December 2019, and they have been compiled in the December 2019 negligence update pamphlet. And it's that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for this CLE course, and the page references are to the pamphlet. The first case is Mutual Redevelopment Houses on page 6. It's an unusual application of the continuous representation doctrine in the context of an engineering firm. The First Department held the negligence action against Skyline, an engineering firm hired to inspect an ongoing heating, ventilation, and air conditioning installation, was not time-barred because the continuous representation doctrine applied to toll the statute of limitations. The court wrote, "Plaintiff demonstrated that the action is not time-barred because the continuous representation doctrine is applicable and tolled the accrual of the limitations period until 2014. Plaintiff submitted evidence showing that Skyline provided special and progress inspection and testing services for phase one of the remediation pursuant to a 2014 agreement. Although this work was completed under a separate agreement, Skyline rendered these services to correct the engineering and construction defects that it failed to identify during its phase one inspection in 2012. Since Skyline continued to provide services in connection with phase one in 2014, the action commenced in 2016 is timely under CPLR 214 subdivision 6. Next is Cullen versus Thumsner on page 7. It's simply a case where the appellate court felt the damages were inadequate. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to set aside the verdict as inadequate in this traffic accident case should have been granted. Plaintiff sustained a torn meniscus in his right knee and irreparable damage to his thumb on his dominant hand. The jury awarded $25,000 for pain and suffering and zero for future pain and suffering. The Second Department held that the past pain and suffering amount should be $100,000 and the future pain and suffering amount should be $50,000. Next is S-Strike on page 8. The issue is whether the plaintiff's decedent, who was in a vegetative state, could sense pain. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the hospital's motion to dismiss the conscious pain and suffering claim should not have been granted. Plaintiff's decedent was in a vegetative state, but there was evidence she was aware of pain. The court said, although she was in a vegetative state, the decedent was generally responsive to pain and sometimes followed commands or responded to verbal stimuli. Although defendants' experts opine that reflex responses to pain, such as grimacing or withdrawing, are not signs of conscious awareness, at least some of the behaviors recorded in the medical records transcend such reflex responses. The medical records also reflect that the decedent was administered pain medication in at least one of defendants' facilities. Although not dispositive, this fact suggests that the decedent's doctors believed that she might be able to experience pain. In addition, plaintiff testified that while at defendant's facilities, the decedent made expressions of pain or emotion such as moaning, crying, or smiling, and communicated with her by blinking. Plaintiff's belief that the decedent blinked in response to questions was reflected in the medical records, although the phenomenon was not itself observed by others. Plaintiff's expert also opined that the decedent had a sufficient level of awareness to enable her to feel pain, as evidenced by the fact that she made facial expressions, smiled, grimaced, moaned, blinked, responded to simple questions, responded to verbal and tactile stimuli, and retracted to pain, all of which were indicators of some level of awareness and conscious pain. Next is Baez on page 10. It's an elevator accident case involving the Espinal factors. The First Department, modifying Supreme Court in this elevator accident case, noted that violation of the New York City building code is some evidence of negligence, but is not negligence per se. And the court also held that Dunwell's, that's the elevator maintenance company's, motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Dunwell had demonstrated two Espinal factors did not apply. It did not displace the building defendant's obligation to keep the elevator safe, and it did not launch an instrument of harm. That is, it did not exacerbate or create the defects in the elevator. Again, for those reasons, the elevator maintenance company's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Next is Ilewat versus P.S. Marcato on page 11. It's another elevator case, and it also involves the Espinal factors. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that one defendant in this elevator accident case, that's Cooper Square, did not demonstrate that it did not displace the building owner's duty to keep the premises safe. And another defendant, P.S. Marcato, the elevator company, sufficiently demonstrated it did not launch an instrument of harm. The court noted that P.S. Marcato's failure to make the elevator safer did not equate to launching an instrument of harm. The court wrote, Cooper Square failed to establish that it did not displace the building owner's duty to maintain the premises in a reasonably safe condition. Its management agreement with the owner authorized Cooper Square to make repairs or alterations to the premises and to purchase supplies and materials for the building. Cooper Square also agreed to directly supervise the work of, hire and discharge all maintenance and security personnel, and was clothed with such general authority and powers as may be necessary or advisable to carry out the spirit and intent of the management agreement. And turning to the other defendant, the elevator company, P.S. Marcato, the court said, P.S. Marcato, which inspected and made repairs to the elevator before plaintiff was injured by it, established that it did not create or exacerbate the dilapidated condition of the elevator, and therefore did not launch a force or instrument of harm. And it's citing the Espinal case, which is 98 New York 2nd at pages 142 and 143. While the record suggests that P.S. Marcato knew that the elevator was in disrepair and was being tampered with, it did nothing more than neglect to make the elevator safer, as opposed to less safe than it was before the inspection and repairs were made. So the Espinal factor, launching an instrument of harm, is more than merely failing to repair something that's in disrepair. Next is the Michael case, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-E, on page 12. It deals with the liability of an out-of-possession landlord. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the out-of-possession landlord, the name was Steph Lay, was not responsible for the repair of a one-step riser inside a warehouse, which allegedly caused plaintiff's slip and fall. The court wrote, an out-of-possession landlord is not liable for injuries that occur on its premises unless the landlord has retained control over the premises and has a duty imposed by statute or assumed by contract or a course of conduct. Here, where the complaint sounds in common law negligence and the pleadings do not allege the violation of a statute, Steph Lay, that's the out-of-possession landlord, demonstrated its entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by establishing that it was an out-of-possession landlord that was not bound by contract or course of conduct to repair the allegedly damaged step. Although the lease obligated Steph Lay to make necessary structural repairs to the interior of the premises, contrary to plaintiff's contentions, the allegedly cracked and eroded single-step riser was not a structural element of the warehouse for which Steph Lay was contractually responsible. Next is Santoro on pages 13 and 14. Here, the plaintiff's decedent's daughter was suing the long-term care facility where her mother had stayed. And the long-term care facility was seeking contribution from the daughter, alleging that her mother was not properly cared for by the daughter after her mother was discharged from the long-term care facility. The second department determined the plaintiff, Santoro, the daughter of the decedent and the executor of her mother's estate, did not owe a duty of a care to her infirm mother, such that Santoro could be sued for contribution by the nursing home her mother's estate was suing. The decedent was released from the nursing home to reside with Santoro. Subsequently, Santoro, as executor, sued the nursing home based upon her mother's fall at the facility. The nursing home then brought a third-party action against Santoro, alleging that the decedent's injuries stemmed from a fall at Santoro's home, resulting from Santoro's negligent care and supervision of her mother. The opinion discusses contribution versus indemnification and all possible theories which might impose a duty upon Santoro, but ultimately held no extant duty was applicable to these facts. The court wrote, "There is no common law duty of a child to care for a parent. While a statutory duty may be imposed in derogation of common law, the defendant here does not rely on any such statute. However, a duty may also be imposed by contract. The general rule is that where the relationship between the parties is that of parent and child, the law presumes that where there is no proof of a contract under which the services were performed, they were rendered gratuitously. A party may also assume a duty to a third party based upon gratuitous conduct. The question is whether the defendant's conduct placed the plaintiff in a more vulnerable position than the plaintiff would have been in had the defendant done nothing. When determining whether a cause of action exists, the question is whether the alleged wrongdoer has launched a force or instrument of harm, not whether the alleged wrongdoer stopped where inaction is at most a refusal to become an instrument of good. In this case, the defendant alleged that Santoro failed to act in accordance with its instructions, which, in its view, would make her an instrument of good, not that she placed the decedent in a more vulnerable position than if she had done nothing. Further, a duty may arise where one has voluntarily assumed the care of another and so secluded the helpless person as to prevent others from rendering aid. However, the defendant cites no duty imposed in derogation of common law. Further, it is not alleged that Santoro secluded the decedent while she was in a helpless state, preventing others from rendering aid. The defendant would impose a new duty on those who live with infirm individuals to use reasonable care and be liable for harm caused by the failure to use reasonable care by affirmative act or omission. The imposition of such an obligation carries with it public policy considerations of possible negative consequences, since such a general obligation could discourage persons from residing with the infirm, discourage children and infirm parents from living together, and discourage the infirm from attempting to resume independent living. The circumstances alleged here provide no justification for creating such a duty." Next is De Leon on pages 14 and 15. It's a case that stems from an assault in a long-term care facility, and it's basically a discovery case, and it involves privilege. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the assailant's medical records were privileged, but any incident reports pertaining to the assault were not. Plaintiff alleged she was attacked while a long-term resident of defendant long-term health care facility, but the assailant in this third-party assault action was not made a party. The court wrote, "We agree with the Supreme Court's determination denying that branch of plaintiff's motion, which sought disclosure of the assailant's admission chart. The assailant is not a party to the action. His medical records were subject to the physician-patient privilege, and he has not waived that privilege. However, Supreme Court should have granted that branch of plaintiff's motion, which sought disclosure of all incident reports related to the assault. Pursuant to Education Law Section 6527, certain documents generated in connection with the performance of a medical or quality assurance review function, or which are required by the Department of Health pursuant to Public Health Law Section 2805-1, are generally not discoverable. The defendant, as the party seeking to invoke that privilege, has the burden of demonstrating that the documents sought were prepared in accordance with the relevant statutes. Here, the defendant merely asserted that a privilege applied to the requested documents without making any showing as to why the privilege attached. Therefore, the incident reports related to the assault were subject to disclosure. So the incident reports in this case were not privileged because the defendant didn't make an effort to demonstrate how those two statutes, the education law and the public health law, related to these particular documents. Next is the Yanchinska case on pages 15 and 16, medical malpractice case that deals with one physician referring the patient to another. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the motion for summary judgment by one of the two doctors, named Dr. Andreyko, shouldn't have been granted. The court wrote, although a medical provider cannot be held vicariously liable for the malpractice of a physician to whom a patient is referred, the referring medical provider may be liable for his or her own independent negligent conduct that proximately causes the patient injury. Here, Andreyko examined the plaintiff on May 30, 2012, and noted the existence of palpable masses tender to palpation in the plaintiff's right breast. Later that day, the plaintiff was examined by Wirtgen, who, though detecting thickening of the right breast, did not detect any palpable masses. Wirtgen reported his findings to Andreyko, who, upon reviewing them, reviewed her notes from her examination of the plaintiff, but did not contact Wirtgen to discuss the differences in their respective examinations. We conclude that the plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether Andreyko, upon learning that Wirtgen was unable to palpate any masses in the plaintiff's right breast, departed from the accepted standard of care by failing to advise Wirtgen that Andreyko had been able to palpate distinct masses in the plaintiff's breast, and whether Andreyko's failure to do so was a substantial factor in contributing to the delay in diagnosis that the plaintiff had breast cancer. Next is Hillary on pages 16-17. It's another medical malpractice case, this time dealing with the continuing treatment doctrine and the statute of limitations. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that the medical malpractice causes of action should not have been dismissed as time-barred. Plaintiff's decedent had seen the defendant's psychiatrist for the first time on November 20, 2014, and the next appointment was set up for December 11, 2014. The defendant alleged he called decedent on November 21, 2014 to tell her she should be treated by someone else, but the December 11, 2014 appointment was not canceled. Decedent committed suicide on November 24, 2014, and the action was commenced exactly 2.5 years after her death on May 24, 2017. The court wrote, the question here is whether the statute of limitations began to run on November 20, 2014, when the decedent met with the defendant for a medical appointment, or 4 days later on November 24, 2014, when she died. The Supreme Court concluded that the limited interactions between the defendant and the decedent failed to give rise to a continuing trust and confidence between them upon which a court could conclude that the decedent anticipated further treatment. However, since a further appointment was scheduled and was not canceled, further treatment of some sort was anticipated, or there at least is a triable issue of fact on that issue. So the second department felt that the fact that that second appointment had not been canceled at least raised a question of fact about whether the continuing treatment doctrine applied to the case, which would make the filing of the case timely by a matter of 4 days. Next is Hubisch on page 17, another medical malpractice case. Here the issue was the admissibility of the doctor's testimony as to his usual practice or his habit in performing a knee replacement operation. The second department, affirming the doctor's verdict, the defense verdict in this medical malpractice action, held that the defendant doctor, Baez, was properly allowed to testify about his usual practice or habit in performing a knee replacement. The court said, Baez's habit testimony as to how he performs knee replacement surgeries, including that the methodology for measuring and dissecting 10 millimeters of the patient's patella did not vary from patient to patient, that the manner in which he performed knee replacement surgeries was done in a deliberate, identical, and repetitive manner on every patient, and that he was in complete control of the circumstances concerning the measuring and dissection of the patient's patella, was properly admitted by the Supreme Court. The evidence supported a finding that Baez's surgical techniques represented a deliberate and repetitive practice by a person in complete control of the circumstances. Next is Georgievsky on page 18, another medical malpractice case, this time dealing with proof of the standard of care. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should not have been granted because defendant did not submit proof of the appropriate standard of care. The defendant, a podiatrist, treated plaintiff for Lyme disease with something called ozone therapy. The court wrote, in this medical malpractice action, plaintiff testified that after he saw an advertisement by a defendant in a magazine about alternative medicine, he sought treatment from defendant for Lyme disease. Defendant is a licensed podiatrist who the record shows told plaintiff that he could treat a host of incurable non-podiatric conditions. Defendant failed to establish the standard of care with which he should have complied for the treatment of Lyme disease, as to which he submitted no expert evidence. Thus, on this record, it can't be determined whether defendant deviated from accepted standards of practice. A trial is required on the issue whether defendant's treatment proximately caused the physical and neurological manifestations of injury alleged by the plaintiff. Next is Mullen on page 19, another medical malpractice case, this time involving the issue of severance. The second department held the action against the doctor, whose name is Wishner, for medical malpractice was properly severed from an action against the doctor's employer for negligent training, supervision, hiring, and retention. Evidence that the doctor had negligently treated another patient would not be admissible in the malpractice action, but it would be admissible in the action against the employer, so severance was properly granted. Next is Lynn, the Lynn case on pages 19 and 20, another medical malpractice action, which raised the issue whether a neurologist and cardiologist, both defendants, were jointly diagnosing and treating the plaintiff. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant doctor's motions for summary judgment in this medical malpractice case should not have been granted. There was a question of fact whether defendants were jointly diagnosing and treating the plaintiff. Defendant neurologist ordered a transesophageal electrocardiogram, called a TEE, to be done by a cardiologist to determine the origin of plaintiff's stroke. Plaintiff alleged defendant neurologist should have made sure the TEE was performed immediately. The TEE was performed more than 2 weeks after plaintiff's initial stroke. Questions exist whether defendants were engaged in joint action in diagnosis or treatment so as to make it appropriate to impose liability on one for the negligence of the other. Next is Rabinovich, another medical malpractice case on pages 20 and 21. And the issue here is whether a certificate of merit should have been filed. The question was whether the cause of action sounded in negligence or in medical malpractice. And the court determined that the action sounded in medical malpractice and therefore a certificate of merit was required. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Dillon, reversing Supreme Court, held one, the action stemming from alleged negligence in drawing blood donated by plaintiffs sounded in medical malpractice, not common law negligence. Two, therefore a certificate of merit was required pursuant to CPLR 3012-A. And three, the failure to provide a certificate of merit does not warrant dismissal of the action. Rather, plaintiff should be allowed 60 days to provide the certificate. The court wrote, the complaint alleges that the defendant failed to properly screen the plaintiff for health problems, obtain her medical history, monitor her physical condition, measure her hemoglobin levels, and keep her at the donation site for a specific period of time to observe any signs of an adverse reaction. The issues of whether the plaintiff needed additional screening, monitoring, or supervision, and whether she was at risk of falling due to a medical condition involved the exercise of medical judgments beyond the common knowledge of ordinary persons. So, even though the plaintiff's injuries stemmed from donating blood, under the Second Department's analysis, the medical malpractice criteria applied, not common law negligence. Next is Barry versus Lee on pages 21 and 22, another medical malpractice case. First Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice case should not have been granted. The majority concluded there was a question of fact whether the administration of a drug, which defendants averred was contraindicated, would have saved decedent's life. Decedent was suffering from a pulmonary embolism upon admission. The staff waited hours for blood tests and an angiogram to confirm the diagnosis. A drug which can dissolve blood clots in minutes was not administered. So again, defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted in that case. Next is Crowbath on pages 22 and 23. It deals with the billing practices of a hospital. Second Department held the complaint did not state a cause of action for negligent concealment or misrepresentation, but it did state a cause of action for violation of General Business Law Section 349, Deceptive Business Practices. The plaintiff alleged defendant hospital failed to disclose material facts about the hospital's billing practices for emergency treatment. The court said, while it cannot be doubted that the relationship between a physician and a patient is one of confidence and trust regarding matters of medical treatment, we decline to hold that such relationship and any duty to speak with care that may come with it also extends to matters of billing having nothing to do with the rendition of medical treatment. We agree with the Supreme Court's determination that the hospital was not entitled to summary judgment dismissing the General Business Law Section 349 cause of action. First, contrary to the hospital's contention, it was engaged in consumer-oriented activity. Second, it's possible to engage in deceptive trade practices through omissions as well as affirmative representations, particularly where, as here, it's alleged that the business alone possesses material information that is relevant to the consumer and fails to provide this information. So the deceptive business practice cause of action survived, but the negligent concealment cause of action based upon the hospital's billing practices did not survive. Next is the Fortune versus Western Beef case on page 23. It's a slip and fall, has to do with constructive notice. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Defendant did not demonstrate a lack of constructive notice of the liquid on the floor. The court wrote, the defendant did not proffer any evidence demonstrating when the specific area where the plaintiff fell was last cleaned or inspected before the accident. Furthermore, the defendant failed to demonstrate that the condition on which the plaintiff fell was not visible and apparent and would not have been discoverable upon a reasonable inspection of the area where the plaintiff was injured. Next is the Burton case on page 24, another slip and fall case involving constructive notice. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment on this ice on sidewalk slip and fall case should not have been granted. The court said, defendants failed to sustain their initial burden of demonstrating that they neither created nor had actual or constructive knowledge of the icy condition of the sidewalk. Neither presented evidence concerning snow removal immediately prior to plaintiff's accident and or their lack of notice of the condition. Next is the Beagle case on pages 24 and 25, another slip and fall, a sidewalk slip and fall. The sidewalk had been elevated by tree roots and some patch had been applied to the sidewalk. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held one, there are questions of fact concerning whether the abutting property owners are liable for this sidewalk slip and fall. Two, there are questions of fact whether the city created the dangerous condition by patching the sidewalk. Plaintiff tripped and fell in an area where the sidewalk had been elevated by tree roots. The court wrote, the charter of the city of Buffalo specifically imposes on owners or occupants of any lands fronting or abutting on any street, that being the property defendants, a duty to maintain and repair the sidewalk, and provides that their failure to do so will result in liability for injuries to users of the sidewalk. Contrary to the property defendant's contention, that duty to maintain and repair extends to damage caused by the roots of a tree owned by the city, where, as here, the local ordinance contains no exceptions to the duty imposed on abutting landowners to maintain the sidewalk, even if the allegedly dangerous condition was created by a root extending from city property. The evidence submitted by the property defendants in support of their motion, which was then incorporated into the city's cross motion, raised tribal issues of fact whether the city performed the cold patch repair to the area sometime before plaintiff's accident, and whether the condition of the sidewalk on the day of plaintiff's accident was the same as when the cold patch was first applied. We thus conclude that the city failed to establish as a matter of law that it did not affirmatively create a dangerous condition, or that the dangerous condition was due solely to conditions that developed over time. Next is the Caro case on page 25, another slip and fall, another constructive notice case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant property owner's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted in this ice on sidewalk slip and fall. The court wrote, here, the property owner failed to establish that it did not have constructive notice of the alleged patch of ice. The deposition testimony of the president of its board of managers merely referred to general inspection practices and provided no evidence regarding any specific inspection of the subject area prior to plaintiff's fall. Next is Fireman's Fund Insurance Company on page 26. It's really an insurance case. First Department, determined plaintiffs are additional insureds under an insurance policy issued by defendant to non-party Upgrade, the contractor hired to restore concrete catwalks. Plaintiffs, Windsor Apartments and Argo Real Estate, are entitled to coverage for a slip and fall in plaintiff's building, allegedly caused by painting the floor all the same color, thereby disguising a change in elevation. And again, this is basically an insurance case involving additional insureds, but I thought it was interesting that the fact that the floor was painted all the same color could be a reason for liability in a slip and fall case. Next is Ashby on page 27. It's a traffic accident case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff was entitled to summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case. The fact that the defendant, named Michael, allegedly stopped at a stop sign before pulling out into plaintiff's path did not raise a question of fact. The court wrote, the plaintiff established her entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability by demonstrating that Michael's negligence in failing to yield the right-of-way was a proximate cause of the accident, and it cites Vehicle and Traffic Law sections 1142A and 1172A. So whether the defendant stopped at a stop sign before pulling into the path of plaintiff's vehicle was irrelevant on the issue of the defendant's liability. Next is Felix on pages 27 and 28. It's another traffic accident case, this time dealing with a bicycle. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant driver was entitled to summary judgment in this bicycle car collision case. Plaintiff was bicycling in the wrong direction on a one-way street. Defendant pulled out into the intersection after checking the traffic in the appropriate direction, and plaintiff ran into the side of defendant's car. The court wrote, the undisputed testimony was that plaintiff was traveling in the opposite direction of traffic in clear violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1231, and traveled into the intersection without stopping or yielding to defendant's vehicle, which was clearly already in the intersection. Admittedly, plaintiff made no attempt to stop or to alert defendant of his presence. Although a driver of a motor vehicle has a duty to see what is there to be seen, defendant was not required to look in the opposite direction of the intersecting one-way street to see if someone was traveling in the wrong direction and at a speed indicating no intent to stop. Next is the Levy case on pages 28 and 29, another traffic accident case, this time involving a pedestrian. The Second Department held defendant driver, Beastie, was entitled to summary judgment in this pedestrian accident case because the act of another driver was the supervening cause of the accident. Beastie had stopped at a stop sign and waved to plaintiff pedestrian, whose name was Nanfro, indicating Beastie would allow Nanfro to cross the street. 1 second later, Nanfro was struck by a car driven by Agostinelli. The court wrote, assuming without deciding that Beastie negligently motioned Nanfro to continue walking across the street and that Nanfro relied upon the gesture, Agostinelli's unforeseeable failure to see what was there to be seen and failure to yield the right of way to Nanfro, who was crossing the street within an unmarked crosswalk, constituted an intervening and superseding cause that established Beastie's prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this CLE course entitled December 2019 Negligence Update. The verification code is PASSENGER. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this CLE course entitled December 2019 Negligence Update is PASSENGER. And the final case in this December 2019 Negligence Update CLE is Belle Fleur on page 32, another traffic accident case involves the failure to yield the right of way, and whether the defendant stopped at a stop sign before pulling out was again deemed irrelevant. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff passenger's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident should have been granted. The Hernandez transit car, in which plaintiffs were passengers, had the right of way on a through road. The defendant, Des Rivière's car, was on an intersecting street with a stop sign. The Second Department held that the fact that the Des Rivières car may have stopped at the stop sign before entering the intersection did not raise a relevant question of fact. That concludes this December 2019 Negligence Update CLE course.